sometimes it's the dead Christ, but it's a very unusual painting in format, because the painting itself is life size, and yet the body of Christ in Holbein's painting looks like a body that has not only been severely harmed physically, but also it's collapsing. It's a shocking sort of spectacle. And his wife said, I could hardly bear to look at it. It was like being in the room with the real body. A little wonder, you know, because as I said, the picture itself is 6 feet long, 10 inches tall. It's about the size of a coffin with one side missing. And you can already see the body has begun to shrink and is in stages of decay. So this particular painting, you remember, is over a door in Rogozhin's house. And it suggests in some ways that there's something cavernous and tomb-like about Rogozhin's house. So sickness, physical and mental, and it's what's inside the body that seems to be, on the one hand, what Dostoevsky focuses on in this novel. That is a sick spirit inside a seemingly healthy body, or a healthy spirit perhaps inside a sickly body, or both, as a matter of fact. Now, you know that Dostoevsky was himself an epileptic, and he wrote this novel out of his own personal experiences. But what you may not know, unless you look through the notebooks, and a lot of Dostoevsky's notebooks survive for the various novels, if you look at the notebooks, you're startled to discover that at the beginning, he had a completely different conception of this novel. He worked through 4 or 5 different plots and sets of characters before he arrived at the definitive version that we have now. And that definitive version creates a number of interesting problems, because those who have read Dostoevsky's letters and who have read his notebooks then have been influenced in their interpretation of this novel. And that interpretation is swayed by what some scholars, and some very well-known scholars, I might add, and a large number of them Russian, what they thought were Dostoevsky's intentions. Now, we can never know a writer's intentions really. Even if a writer thinks he is doing something, the imagination takes over, and he may well come out with something totally different. And so I'm going to talk about that a little bit today, although not so much if you haven't finished the novel as to preempt the ending. Although Dostoevsky did say that the climax of the novel was something he had in mind the whole time. And you can't help but realize that it's going to end in death. And this image of the dead body then haunts the whole novel. In fact, death itself haunts all of these characters in one way or another. All right, so the epileptic fit is nevertheless an ambiguous sort of motif in this novel. For one thing, Mishkin, in the course of one of his fits, gives a description of his mind at the time. And suddenly he says he's lost control of his body, he falls down, but suddenly, mentally, he sees everything with great clarity. It's almost like a mystical experience. Now, it's likely that Dostoevsky was describing this himself from experience, but don't forget that when a novelist takes his own experiences and puts them into fiction, he subordinates that experience to the form of the whole. And he may or may not be. In fact, we have no right to say that this is Dostoevsky actually describing one of his own epileptic fits. It could be, and even if it is, in itself it has no meaning. But when it's placed in a novel, then it takes on a totally different set of meanings and a totally different dynamism. And so is the case here. Because one of the themes in this novel is death and resurrection. Although, in some ways, I'm afraid it's a bitter motif, the motif of resurrection. Now, if you didn't realize this, Anastasis in Greek means resurrection. Anastasis, the state of going up. In fact, it's exactly cognate with the Latin resurrectio. Well, what is the principal female figure's first name? It's Anastasia. And this comes from the Greek Anastasis. So her first name means resurrection. Her last name, interestingly enough, Barashkov, suggests the Russian word Barashek, which means lamb. And so we are inclined to see her as something of a sacrificial lamb. She has been an orphan, and she has been sacrificed in more ways than one. First of all, by the man who is her guardian, and who at one point had hoped to marry her, but in her teens, when she tells him that she hates him, he's suddenly shocked, because he thinks all this time he has been a good guardian, has given her, you know, an education, he's given her governesses, he's given her good things. He doesn't understand why she should hate him so. And of course we understand that Nastasia, I think, hates him because she sees through him. She sees ultimately that he has ulterior motives somehow. A recent book, actually published in 2004, if I continue on this in a subsequent class, I'll mention some of, but it is on the way in which each of these characters constructs a story about himself or herself. And in fact, it is a world of scripts. All these characters seem to have scripts. And the scripts are, on the one hand, their attitude towards the world and where they think they belong in it, but also their sense that some sort of destiny or fate awaits them. And this is especially true of Rogozhin, who himself is a man of violence, who is an unsettled and unsettling character, and who is, in fact, a kind of double of the younger teenager, nihilist, and Dostoevsky uses that term, nihilist, that is to say, Hippolyte. Hippolyte, whose name, as a matter of fact, in Greek, means tamer of horses, Hippolytus. Furthermore, we have Mushkin's name. Dr. Cowan mentioned last time that Mush in Russian means mouse. On the other hand, his first name is Lev, or Leo. We all know that Leo means lion in Latin. So this is a rather incongruous conjunction of the lion and the mouse. I don't know whether we're supposed to think of Aesop's fable, but it suggests, on the one hand, great strength, on the other hand, great susceptibility and weakness and timidity. And so Dostoevsky seems to be pointing towards the very interesting ambiguity and paradox in Mushkin's character, in his very name. Names are very often important, by the way, in Dostoevsky's works. We also have the three daughters, the youngest and prettiest of whom goes by the name of Aglaya. Anybody know where the name Aglaya comes from? It's another Greek name. Well, it means...
Is it the Greek word for truth?
No, that's aletheia. Or aletheia. Spelled A-L-T-H-E-I-A. No, Aglaya is one of the three graces. And interestingly enough, she has three sisters, doesn't she? And Aglaya, of the three graces, is the one who stands for beauty. Now, the three graces are three different kinds of grace, the grace of beauty, and so on and so forth. But Dostoevsky doesn't seem to push it much further than that, because in some way, these three graces are slightly ironic. Not that they aren't lovely girls and all of that, but they themselves have a streak of the rebel about them. They're constantly trying to counter their mother. And we see this consistently throughout the novel. But at the same time, if we look at their names, what are the two sisters?
Adelaida
and
Alexandra.
Now, it's interesting. Alexandros in Greek means protector or defender of men. And Adelaide in German, it's Old German for noble. In modern German, it'd be edel, of course. But it's an Old German word that means noble. So here, the three graces are the noble, the warrior, and the beautiful. Rather a shift away from the classical graces. I haven't, in my own mind, decided exactly what I think that might be, if Dostoevsky is playing with this at all. But I think it's pretty clear that he is playing with the allusion to the three graces. No doubt about that. However, there are three graces in a mercantile world. In a society that, in this book, is itself, and here's where I think the epilepsy comes in, the epilepsy is a kind of death and resurrection, but also, and equally important, I think, the graces are set down in a world that seems to be, you might say, not only money obsessed, but it's a society that's built on money. There's a whole lot of talk about money in Dostoevsky's novels. It's what makes him seem so contemporary, so much a part of our world. But there are other things. There's the railway. There's a mention of a telegram. Now remember, this novel was written in 1868, and we forget that already mass communications and mass transport are available, as they had not been only a few years before. This is a period of rapid progress in inventions, especially mechanical inventions. And you may recall that Hippolyte says about Holbein's painting of the dead Christ, it's as though nature were some terrible, tyrannical machine that's crushing this body to bits, grinding it to dust. And this is Hippolyte's view. And so for Hippolyte, the radical youngster, and by the way, you know, recently there's a young man, 19, who to the shock of his friends and neighbors was arrested for trying to set off a bomb in Dallas.
Recently?
And
so, Like recently as in now?
Yeah, like today.
Really?
Yeah, it's been ongoing for several days, yeah. Well, you're in the ivory tower. Just hope they don't try to blow up the ivory tower. That's it. But be that as it may, you know, you have to bear in mind that a lot of these so-called revolutionaries are quite young. They're your age and younger even. So these are young people who are, in fact, of a generation that split them off from their elders. Once again, we get the theme of fathers and sons. But here, and in the next novel we'll be reading, we'll see it pushed further than Turgenev pushed it in his novel. So here, the representative, the main representative, is Ippolit, trainer of horses. And this is exactly, remember, Bazarov is interested in taming nature. And there is this wild, unpredictable side of things that Ippolit, tamer of horses, is interested in trying to bring under control. And of course, he can't. He's consumptive, and his own body has already betrayed him at the age of 18 or 17.
Mm-hmm. Just a thought. I did notice this striking parallel, and I was wondering if with this young, promising, dying nihilist, Dostoevsky was intentionally trying to echo
Fathers and Sons?
Yeah, because he would have read it, wouldn't he have?
Oh, he didn't just read it. He read the manuscript and told Turgenev that he liked it.
Really?
And Turgenev was very pleased because he and Dostoevsky had not gotten along at all.
Really?
Earlier, before Dostoevsky was sent off to Siberia. Mm. This is after Dostoevsky returned in 1861. So now Dostoevsky was thoroughly familiar with it. And in the Pushkin speech, by the way, Dostoevsky congratulated Turgenev on having created the one and only positive female figure in Russian fiction. And this was years later. And Turgenev was present and blew Dostoevsky a kiss, as a matter of fact.
Would this person be Anna Sergeyevna?
Would be what?
Anna Sergeyevna?
This is in a later novel called A Nest of Gentle Folk, is the way it's often translated, the title. It's a later novel. So, but look, Dostoevsky didn't have to have read Fathers and Sons to have used the word that Turgenev introduced into Russia, nihilist, because it was everywhere. It was picked up from Turgenev and applied to this generation of radicals. 7 years later, it was in full currency when Dostoevsky was writing this. Now, I don't know if you're aware of this or not, but if you go to Florence today and to the Pitti Palace, did anybody happen to visit the Pitti Palace in Florence?
Doge's Palace?
Yeah. No, not the Doge's, that's Venice.
Yeah.
Florence. Yeah. Did you notice something interesting there? A plaque on the wall?
I'll admit it, I'll take them all.
Well, it says here Dostoevsky began writing The Idiot. Because this was written in Europe, not in Russia. Dostoevsky had to leave Russia because of his debts. And so he wrote these novels to make enough money so that he could return and pay his debts. I won't go into Dostoevsky's biography. And by the way, I made a little mistake online. I'll take it off on Blackboard. I put the complete chronology of Dostoevsky's biography online, and I said you can compare it with the one that's in your edition of Dostoevsky's The Devils. Well, you don't have the edition that I thought you had, so don't look for it. It's not there. But I did put one online. And incidentally, a couple of other things under the Dostoevsky folder on Blackboard, if you want to take a look at those. All right, so the epileptic fit, then, the sacrificial lamb. We think of Myshkin, the mouse, with the heart of a lion, maybe. We think of him as being the sacrificial lamb, but in fact, it's really Nastasia. Now, if we go a step further, we can say that then what is dominant in this novel is this image of intense physical and mental suffering that comes out of that Holbein painting. As a result of reading Dostoevsky's notebooks, a number of Russian critics and thinkers have called Mishkin a Christ figure. That is, he's supposed to be a kind of symbolic representation of Christ. Bear in mind that Dostoevsky never really said that anywhere. This was a deduction. What he did say was that he wanted to write a novel about a truly beautiful man. So, what does that mean? Well, it could mean a number of things, but one of the interesting things is that Dostoevsky very often is not content to allude to other books in his novels. And you've already seen that as early as Poor Folk, where two of the stories that he draws on from Pushkin and Gogol are actually mentioned in the novella. And he does that in this book as well. And I'm going to talk about some of these other literary works that he alludes to. One is the Apocalypse from the Bible, and the other is yet another Pushkin poem, in this case, and you know that lines from it are actually read aloud by Aglaya at one point in the novel. Right, so, but what about the name Mishkin? Well, at one point, it is pointed out that Mishkin comes from an old family and that it is in a book. It is indeed in a book. The first thoroughgoing history of the Russian state by Karamzin, who was a man of letters from the late 18th, early 19th century, therefore of an earlier generation than Dostoevsky's, he wrote the first very thorough history of Russia. And in it, he mentions the name of a Mishkin. That's a real name. Now, Mishkin is the last of his line.
Is this except the same history that's on the table in Robertson's?
That's it. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. The History of the Russian State by Karamzin.
I guess I should. No, I'm not going to write it down, am I? No, not permitted.
You may not write.
Air writing. K-A-R-A-M-Z-I-N. Anyway, Karamzin. Well, this Mishkin, however, was not a nobleman, not a baron or a prince. He was an architect. And Dostoevsky would not have left a clue like this in his novel without expecting us to see it. All the more surprising that apparently until recently, in Richard PVR and his wife, PVR and Volokhonsky, his wife, have translated now all of Dostoevsky's major novels. And in the introduction to his translation of this novel, he points this out, that Mishkin was an architect in the 15th century who built a cathedral. Oh, thank you. Prominent man of letters at the end of the 18th century and lived on in the 19th century. Architect of a 15th century cathedral. He designed a church for Moscow that was meant to be grander than anything else in Moscow. It was based on a famous Cathedral in Vladimir, Russia. You know, one of the old, old cities. Goes way back to the Middle Ages. It's the Cathedral of the Dormition. Right, so Cathedral to the Virgin Mary. Now that's an important clue, but boy, is it buried. Of course, Dostoevsky would have expected his readers to know at least some of Karamzin. If they didn't remember this, they might look it up anyway. And they would know that he was the architect who had designed this magnificent cathedral in Moscow that was based on the cathedral dedicated to the Virgin in Vladimir, a historical, famous cathedral in Russia, except it was bigger. And he was, when they were building it, they tried to put in a spiral staircase, and it caused the entire structure to collapse. All right, so that...
Yes.
No. That one's still there. No, it was Mushkin, the architect's Moscow, you might say, enlargement of it that suffered from a structural flaw and collapsed completely while they were building it. They never finished it. And, of course, he was disgraced. Now, you see, it has to give you pause, because Mushkin is this incredibly complex figure in the novel. Everybody seems to like him, and yet there's something troubling about him. So we'll see more of that a bit later. Well, if he's both a mouse and a lion, he also has another heritage, and that is he is the figure of the holy fool. And we get this figure of the holy fool, the idiot, idiot in Russian. We get this figure from the Middle Ages and on, the simpleton who is pure of heart, who is good, who is, in fact, a beautiful person. And by the way, when Dostoevsky speaks of a beautiful man or a beautiful person in his notebooks and in his letters, he means exactly the same thing that was meant by the beautiful people. Well, not exactly, no. He meant something like what was meant by the beautiful people in the 60s and 70s of our recently expired century. You know, the people whose hearts are in the right place, who, you know, want to do good, and so on and so forth. Now, truly, he said he wanted his hero to be a truly beautiful man. Now, this goes back to that problem of the positive hero that ultimately will finally reach its apotheosis, as it were, in Soviet fiction, where you can't have anything bad in the hero. Where the hero has to be all good and all earnest and all communist, of course. All right, so the main idea he had of the novel then was to portray this holy fool. And we can't help noticing that there is another allusion in the novel that leaves us yet another clue as to what Dostoevsky is doing. When Aglaya puts Mishkin's letter in a book, and you remember this was mentioned last time, what book is it? Don Quixote. And this is from Dostoevsky had a favorite niece, and he wrote to her about what he was working on. So now remember, he's outside of Russia now, and he wrote to her about his work in progress. The main idea of the novel, he says, is to portray a positively beautiful man. There's nothing more difficult in the world, and especially now. All writers, not only ours, but even all European writers, who've merely attempted to portray the positively beautiful have always given up. Because the task is immeasurable. The beautiful is an ideal, but this ideal, whether ours or that of civilized Europe, is still far from being worked out. There's only one perfectly beautiful person, Christ, so that the appearance of this immeasurably, infinitely beautiful person is, of course, already an infinite miracle. That is the sense, he says, of the whole Gospel of John. It finds the whole miracle in the incarnation alone, in the manifestation of the beautiful alone. And I pause here for a minute to point out that incarnation is what this novel is about. But there is something terribly wrong with what's going on in the modern world. Somehow, we are not whole people. We are split radically. Anyway, Dostoevsky says, but I've gone on too long. I will only mention that of beautiful persons in Christian literature, the most fully realized is Don Quixote. But he is beautiful solely because he is at the same time ridiculous. So Dostoevsky puts Don Quixote in the line of the Russian holy fools. See, the man who has high purposes, but is a fool, who is ridiculous, who is, Cervantes says, crazy, mad. Dickens' Pickwick, an infinitely weaker conception than Don Quixote, but an immense one, all the same, is also ridiculous and succeeds only because of that. Compassion is shown for the beautiful that is ridiculed and does not know its own worth, and so sympathy appears in the readers. Now, you have to be struck by the fact that he's talking about contemporary literature here. Don Quixote, okay, is 1605 and 1650, but now he's talking about Dickens and the Pickwick Papers, and he's talking about Les Misérables of Victor Hugo. This arousing of compassion is the secret of humor. Jean Valjean from Hugo's Les Misérables is also a strong attempt, but he arouses sympathy by his terrible misfortune and society's injustice towards him. I have nothing like that, decidedly nothing, and that's why I'm terribly afraid it will be a positive failure. He's afraid that he can't create this positively beautiful person in a convincing way. And this is early on as he's working on the novel. But you can see where the idea of Mishkin as Christ figure comes from. It comes from letters like this or passages in the notebook where we see Dostoevsky struggling again and again. But guess what? In an earlier, in the first drafts of the novel, the epileptic was the villain. He was the man who was the selfish one, the egoist, the one who was concerned with himself. And it's only later he splits this character into two. The epileptic becomes Mishkin, and the man who is super egoist becomes Rogozhin.
Uh-huh. Can you talk about the connection between Prince Mishkin and the Grand Inquisitor scene?
In The Brothers Karamazov?
Yeah, is there a connection there?
Well, there is, but you know, we better wait till we get to The Brothers Karamazov.
Okay, sorry.
There certainly is.
Uh-huh.
Could you comment on Michigan's calligraphy?
I'll do that in just a minute.
Mm-hmm.
Could you go over
the connection? It's on the agenda. Yes, sir?
Could you go over the connection between the Gospel of John and the...
It's on the agenda. Don't worry, we'll get there. If we don't spend too much time answering your questions. Yeah.
You mentioned that Dostoevsky lived for a while in Italy and that he read Don Quixote. Did he speak Italian and Spanish in addition to German, French, English, and Russian?
I don't think he had to speak Spanish. It was translated into Russian.
Okay.
Russians all knew it.
How about Italian?
He knew some Italian, sure. He also knew some German, and he knew French. Remember, he had translated from French. But look, educated Russians did this.
Dang.
If you want to feel inferior, it's all right.
Very inferior.
All right. Later, he wrote to the same niece as he is working on the fourth part now. So this is not at the beginning, but at the end. He says, the novel was almost written and conceived for the novel's denouement. In other words, by the time he had found what he was doing, he knew what would be the consequences of the forces and the personalities that he had set in motion. So he knew where they were going to end up. And there are clues at the beginning of the novel, of course, that point in that direction. It's no surprise to us that the whole seeming love triangle involving Mishkin and Natasha and Rogozhin ends up the way it does. On the other hand, it's very important to recognize that Dostoevsky refused to impose an ideological formula on the plot, Christian or otherwise. The narrator himself is very interesting in this novel. I don't know if you've noticed this, but the narrator, who is an omniscient narrator, nevertheless doesn't know everything. He's in doubt about certain things. He can tell us how somebody looks, how he acts, how he or she thinks, perhaps, but it's almost always from the outside. It's as though there's something going on that even the narrator can't quite penetrate. Furthermore, we view characters in this novel from the perspective of other characters. We see a constant interplay of interpretations of Mishkin and of Natasha and all the others. There's hardly a character in this novel who isn't seen from multiple perspectives. And that gives us an opportunity to talk once more about Bakhtin's famous book, Problems of Dostoevsky's Poetics. What he says, we mentioned this before, but it bears repetition. Bakhtin contrasts Dostoevsky's technique, which can seem very confusing at times. It's a technique in which multiple voices come into play, but no one voice, not even the narrator's, represents the ideological voice that controls the whole novel. Now, this is very important to recognize. In other words, Dostoevsky was a believing Christian, but as a believing Christian, his beliefs about the world and anything beyond it have to come out of the physical action. We cannot be told what to think. In other words, this is dramatic. These characters are as though they were on stage, or as though we were watching them through some fly-on-the-wall perspective. And we have to draw our own conclusions, and it's sometimes confusing because characters contradict one another. is that wonderful scene that I hope we have time to get to, towards the end of part two, the newspaper article. After a series of these polite tete-a-tete scenes in which these people haplessly get together for a nice social occasion, and the whole business is blown to bits by outrageous behavior, whether Nastasia's or someone else's. And so through all of this, then we sort of have to sort through the rubble to make sense of what's going on. There is no one voice that allows us to interpret the novel. We have to put them all together. So what Bakhtin says is that the homophonic or monologic European novel, where heroes are heroes and villains are villains, and we're pretty clear about who they are. This is Dickens, for example. We're pretty clear about who the good people are and who the bad people are. Dostoevsky, something different happens, and this surely comes out of the atmosphere of the 19th century, where ideologies were in constant conflict. Not just the Westerners and the Slavophiles, but all kinds of splits and eddies and currents within those positions. And so even a Slavophile then is a collection of voices that sometimes argue with and contradict one another. And Westernizers run a gamut from extreme radicals to moderates, or even conservatives like Turgenev. So Bakhtin says, from the viewpoint of a consistently monologic visualization and understanding of the represented world, from the viewpoint of some monologic canon for the proper construction of novels, and here he has in mind the accusation that Dostoevsky's novels are a hodgepodge. They have no structure. There's no art to them, that they're a mess. He says, no, no. Dostoevsky's world may seem a chaos, and the construction of his novels some sort of conglomerate of disparate materials and incompatible materials, principles, for shaping them. Only in the light of Dostoevsky's fundamental artistic task, which we will formulate here, can one begin to understand the profound organic cohesion, consistency, and wholeness of Dostoevsky's poetics. And he goes on a few paragraphs later to say that critical literature on Dostoevsky has been, until very recently, too direct an ideological echoing of the voices of his heroes. In other words, as though you can take what Dostoevsky's heroes say as Dostoevsky's convictions. But Bakhtin would say, no. Some critics enslaved by the content of individual heroes' ideological views have attempted to reduce those views to a systematically monologic whole, thus ignoring the fundamental plurality of unmerged consciousness, which is part and parcel of the artist's design. And Dostoevsky was the first, really, to introduce ideas in dialogue into the novel. That is, not just any old ideas, but the ideas being circulated and argued about in the present. So the battle here is a battle of ideologies now, not just ideas, but ideologies. Well, we'll have more to say later about some of Bakhtin's very interesting comments, and I'm going to draw on him, I hope, if I have time, a little bit later on to talk about this Don Quixote figure, where Bakhtin also talks about carnivalization, the turning of the world upside down, which occurs in quite a number of other works. particularly in Rabelais, whom Bakhtin wrote a book about after he wrote this one. But the most interesting aspect of this is the figure of the fool, the carnival fool, who becomes the crowned king of carnival, but who has to be deposed at the end. Now, I think I may have mentioned this already, did I not? And in this, we can see now another dimension to Mishkin. He is the carnival fool, who is elevated, who is treated with a kind of mock dignity, but nevertheless a dignity, given all kinds of powers, made able to make and dispense laws and do all sorts of things, but who is at the same time part of this carnivalesque spirit of mocking the normal order as we know it, the official order, which is inverted, turned upside down. And this carnivalization goes on in every single one of these almost absurd social gatherings that are consistently interrupted, and where decorum goes out the window almost immediately. All right, so there's the other side. Mishkin's fascination with executions and the fear of death. And remember, he talks about the man who was given a reprieve at the last minute. You recall that scene? He talks about the death of Marie. He was surprised that it happened when it did. He thought she was getting better. But he is asked to tell some stories, you remember, to the three sisters and Madame General Yepanchin. And what he tells them are these gory, awful things that he has witnessed. First of all, the pathetic story of Marie, and then the guillotine executions. Far better, he says, though, to have been executed in the guillotine than the horrifying experience of thinking you're going to die and be all over, and then having it not happen. 10 times worse, he says. And of course, we know that this is exactly Dostoevsky's experience. Be that as it may, we don't learn very much about Dostoevsky from these stories that he tells, but we learn a lot about Mishkin. That Mishkin himself then has and every character in the book, in fact, has some sort of problematic relationship with death. So just as the story of Marie shows the difference between love and pity, and remember, Mishkin says he doesn't love Nastasya, he pities her. So and we have to worry a bit about that statement. He wants to marry her. We see this happen more than once in the book, by the way. She agrees to marry him, and then she runs away. Why? She says, I'm not good enough for him. Mishkin is perfectly willing to marry her, but perhaps she's not giving her real reason. Perhaps she runs away from him because Rogozhin, she knows, at least loves her and doesn't pity her one bit. He loves her for what she is. And that makes all the difference. And she is not afraid of death. Not really. She's ready to embrace it. Mishkin's stories tell us that this may not be true of him. And we have to think that if Mishkin were a real Christ figure, literally, I mean, then he would embrace his own death. Now, he's a humble man, and he's an open and sincere man. And in this kind of sophisticated, complicated society that is the upper class in Russia, yeah, you will seem like an idiot, an oaf, if you're that way. Refreshing from time to time. Someone you feel you can trust, but one wonders. All right, so the story of Marie on the one hand and the story of the executions give us this terrible sense of foreboding, this dread of death that hovers over the whole novel. And of course there is Hippolyte, who is dying, and who knows he's going to die towards the end of part two. And it's one of the positive aspects of this double. And now look at the doubles here. Rogozhin and Hippolyte are two sides of the same coin. One older, one younger. One vigorous, powerful, violent, and passionate. The other, a kind of Bazarov, as a matter of fact. You know, an idea adolescent is what he is. Who thinks that you're going to convince people just by telling them. He admits as much in that scene after the scene with the newspaper article. So what's going on here? What did Dostoevsky do? Well, Dostoevsky was so thoroughly tuned to contemporary thought and what was going on that we can see here that what his Mushkin turns out to be is a kind of Christ, according to the French author Ernest Renan. You know, I was reading Renan, they caused a certain British novelist, George Eliot, to lose her faith. So what is the vie de Jésus of Renan? Renan says, well, of course Christ wasn't God. You know, he was a human being like the rest of us, but he was a beautiful person. Does that suggest something? He doesn't quite use those words. He says he was a good man and a great teacher. And we ought to follow his example, not because he was God incarnate, but because he was the best of men.
Mm-hmm. Who caused this woman to lose her faith? Dostoevsky or Renan?
Renan.
Renan, okay.
I don't know that George Eliot ever read Dostoevsky. I don't think she knew Russian anyway.
She could have read it in translation?
She could have, but barely. Yeah. It's unlikely, I think. I don't know. I don't think she did. Well, all right. So what is Renan's Christ? Or his Jesus, rather. It doesn't seem quite right to call him Christ if he's not divine. So Renan's Jesus is a Christ without the power to redeem. Now, how does Mishkin deal with the question of redemption? Well, he talks about forgiveness, does he not? We must forgive. But he also says of Marie and Nastasia that neither of them is to blame. You remember that? It's not your fault. You're not guilty. You're not to blame. You are pure, he tells Nastasia. In a certain sense, that's true, that is. But Nastasya doesn't think she's not to blame. Nastasya is willful. She is a carnivalesque figure. She is a breaker of the rules. She is a rebel against this smug and complacent society that she has been a captive victim of ever since she was orphaned. And she resents it. It's interesting that, you remember Mishkin says that he was in a mental depression in spiritual darkness, and he was awakened from it by the braying of an ass. Something real. But then, again, it's a kind of carnival figure. You know, this bringing of things down to earth, down to the ordinary, down to the body, as it were. Now, another thing that's very interesting in this novel is Dostoevsky's use of the unspoken. It's part of his polyphonic method. So much is not said. It has to be deduced. It has to be teased out. First of all, by the characters themselves. The unspoken plays a great role in this novel, but also by the reader, because the narrator will not tell us. And we suspect that the narrator is as much a character in this novel as anybody else, because he doesn't seem to know sometimes. It's what is passed over. And what's so striking here is that it is the very things that are passed over that nobody mentions that turn out to be important. And they are passed over even during the most outrageous violations of social decorum. The things that normally you would keep quiet are brought out into the open. The things that you would normally want to know about are passed over as though they're self-evident or everybody knows them or they're not worth talking about. And then finally, there is the statement attributed to Mishkin that beauty will save the world. And we think back to Nastasya Filipovna and Aglaya. Beauty will save the world. This is an aesthetic understanding of salvation. Not grace in the theological sense, but beauty. And so this is why, I think, the three sisters are an allusion to the three graces. This is what happens when you think that beauty will save the world. What do you get? You get what both Nastasya and Aglaya get in the end, but I won't go that far just yet. Now, you remember that it's not only the voices of various characters, but there are the voices of other writers that come into play. So Dostoevsky mentions in working on the Idiot that the voice of Dickens and the voice of Victor Hugo and others are in some ways in dialogue with him as he's writing, but the voice of Pushkin is certainly there. You remember that Aglaya reads from Pushkin's poem, The Poor Knight, and by the way, yes, I have put the whole poem on blackboard for you. I have an absolutely unending conviction that you will want to read all these things. And so I go to the trouble of posting them. So there is this poem, The Poor Knight, but it's interesting that Pushkin also wrote a short play, one of the so-called little tragedies, called The Covetous Knight. And it's very interesting. So The Poor Knight is a pseudo-medieval ballad, as the Rhyme of the Ancient Mariner is, for example. that Pushkin wrote in 1829, though it wasn't published until the 1850s after his death. And Dostoevsky has Aglaya recite a section from it. Well, there is that voice. Also, later on in the novel, there is Alexandre Dumas' fils, that is Junior, and his novel, La Dame aux Camélias, the camellia lady, which was made into an opera by Verdi called La Traviata, by the way, Violetta, and the Emma of Madame Bovary. Because both of these novels are alluded to in the course of the novel. Well, Madame Bovary is from the earlier part of the 1860s. So here again, we have something going on. In fact, a copy of it is lying on a table in one scene. Well, what's going on here? This is, of course, about NFB. And it's interesting that Aglaya gets AMD. She says AMD. And says, no, it's ANB. And she says, I don't care what it is. I mean something. I know what I mean by it. So the story of the poor knight is a story of a knight who doesn't pray to the Trinity, but only to the Virgin Mary. And he dies, but he is out in the wilderness and can't receive extreme unction, the last sacrament. And so when he goes to heaven, they have to get a little committee together and decide what to do. And they say, well, you know, I don't know. You know, he didn't say his prayers and, you know, he didn't receive the sacrament. Can we really let him in? And the Virgin Mary, to whom he has been faithful, then appears and persuades the heavenly powers to let him in. All right, so, and of course, this is, the letters refer to the Virgin Mary, and Aglaya mischievously puts in Nastasia's initials. He worships Nastasia as the poor knight worshipped the Virgin Mary. And when we can see that, in a sense, then Mishkin is the poor knight. But we wonder if, well, we won't know what his outcome will be. We have no way of knowing. Now, the covetous knight is an interesting story too, and by golly, I'm pretty sure that Dostoevsky is also alluding to it in this novel. It's a short drama of two acts. In the first act, we hear the young son, who's a knight, it also is set in the Middle Ages. He's a knight, but he has no money. And his father won't give him any money. His father is a miser. And in the second act, we see the father who's heaped up all these treasures and heaps them up for the sake of treasure, simply. A duke comes to beg him to give his son some money so that he can live properly and come to court. And the father argues with him and refuses, and then suddenly drops dead. Now, what the story is about, of course, is two generations. The generation of the young who want fun and life and enjoyment, and the old fogies of the older generation who sit on top of everything, who refuse to countenance or allow anything new into their lives, who disapprove of everything the younger generation does, and who live in a society dominated by the value of money rather than the value of the future, and who don't believe in the future And this leads us now to our last theme, apocalypse. Oh boy, is this a big one. And of course, this in turn is referred to in the course of the novel. It begins in a strange way with the exchange of crosses between Mushkin and Rogozhin. They are doubles, they are brothers, they are opposites in some way, and yet there is some connection between them, and it goes beyond their love triangle with Nastasya. But if you think about it for a moment, if Dostoevsky really did expect us to realize that behind the very common name, Anastasia, lies resurrection, then we could say that what they both have in common is a desire for something that goes beyond death. Rogozhin's passion and Mushkin's pity for the suffering, both of them, it seems to me, are pointed in this direction. Now, this is eschatological. The eschaton, the place of revelation and the place where things reach their ending, their proper ending. The unveiling, apokalypsis in Greek means unveiling or revealing. So the apocalypse is that moment when all is shown forth, and when history then finally reveals its direction and its outcome. Now, this is a very old idea, but it is particularly important in Russian thought, and it explains why Marxism did so well for a time in Russia, because all it is a secularizing of apocalyptic thought, religious and sacred apocalyptic thought. So it goes back to the Jewish sense of mission as a chosen people, that a Messiah will come, and the Messiah then will lead the Jews as a nation and through the Jews, the rest of the world, to the eschaton, to the ultimate end of all things. That is, to the salvation of the world. The Jews will be, as a people, the chosen vessel of the salvation of the world. Now, that gets transformed in Christianity, because in Christianity, we have something else in the background, and that is the Greek myth, and to some extent the Roman myth, of the declining world. If you look at Greek mythology, you see that the world isn't progressing towards some higher point of existence. It's been downhill ever since. If you look at Hesiod, for example, and the genealogy of the gods, you discover that with each generation, things get worse and worse. And by the way, this was a notion that dominated a good part of European thought all the way up through the 18th century. It was even thought to be biologically true that species decline. This will be replaced later by a notion that species get more complex, and in becoming more complex, they become better. And so we are at the long line of evolution as a result. Well, for Christianity, these two strains then are in a certain sense mixed. So for the Greeks, things decline and then they can go no further, and then we have an eternal return. History is a cycle. But for Christian thought, especially beginning with St. Augustine and in the Bible itself, we see transformation. We have the loss of the Garden of Eden, but that shall be replaced eventually by the heavenly Jerusalem. A garden will become a city, and a city is different from a garden because it bears the impact of human existence on it. The heavenly Jerusalem, the city then, is a place that man has built. It is a place in man's image. It's not natural any longer. It is man cooperating in God's work. Now, what Augustine did in the City of God was to give us the notion of a sacred history of human salvation, but a secular account of history as a series of random, undirected events that take shape only retrospectively, if at all. All right, so for St. Augustine, there is the City of God and the City of Man. Man can progress spiritually, but not materially, and without this sacred dimension, not really morally. We don't get any better in the secular world. We don't improve. It's only through grace that we improve. Now, this gets into Russian thought at a very early period, but and we'll have to talk about this next time a bit, depending on how Dr. Cowan is feeling on Thursday. But I've advised him because my mother was an asthmatic and died with complications from asthma, and my wife works in a pulmonary clinic. I take anything involving the respiratory system very, very seriously, so I don't want him to come back prematurely. Very timely warning there. So bear in mind what happens to Hippolyte, and take care of yourselves. We'll see you next time.